This is Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo, number 320. The home station is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. Science inexorably pushes back the wall of ignorance, which has been mankind's bane forever. It's those shrinking areas yet to be explained where religion and superstition flourish. When phenomena defy explanation, people have been quick to ascribe them to the devil, if malign, or to miracles, if benign. As an atheist, I reject the idea of such interventions, usually. Here in Prince George, I often witness certain events I cannot explain. Perhaps one day my ignorance will be smothered with simple findings, but as for now, I find no elimination. I refer, of course, to the near instantaneous fluctuation of our town's gasoline prices. I notice an adjustment in one gas station and see that it has spread to all, right down to that insidious last mill, presumably within moments. At one time, I suspected complicity, conspiracy, or collusion, but none of these have been disproven time and again through official investigations. This leaves no other reasonable accounting for simultaneous price movements than divine intervention in the form of miracles or the works of Satan. Amen. I was 9 years old when the first television set appeared in our suburban neighborhood. My family initially held out, but the next year we succumbed and a console TV dominated our living room. Television was celebrated as a vehicle to bring education and information into every home, lifting clouds of ignorance and misunderstanding. TV would allow different societies to learn from and about each other, eventually eliminating separations which had led to wars. What a grand day for civilization. In the United States, television was immediately hijacked by corporate interest, to which this new medium was just another opportunity for profit. Its small black and white screen brought us images of Ed Sullivan's variety shows, I Love Lucy, roller derbies, stage wrestling, and endless old English movies, all supported by advertising. Advertising for amazing kitchen appliances, cigarettes recommended by doctors, paste to save our teeth, detergents to whiten our laundry. It was endless, crude, and intrusive, but we got used to it. And we bought those wondrous products, fattening the coffers of corporate sponsors. Nations, like some in Europe, staked out channels for the public, but Canada's feeble attempt through the CBC became just another commercial operation. Italy has three government channels and three private ones, all controlled by one man, the billionaire Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, who bought and fornicated his way into office. Oh yes, there are fine shows on today's telly, but it's odd that the same people who tell me what wondrous educational stuff is on air seem to have trash on their screens when I visit them. Here we are in an era when many homes have oversized flat-screen, high-definition televisions hanging on their walls, but the fare is the same. Dumb situation comedies, mindless talk shows, occupational sports, and ubiquitous, intrusive, offensive advertising. If television is, as some say, a vast wasteland, it's a very lucrative wasteland for advertisers. Television is supposedly a free medium allowing one to be entertained at home without cost. Not so. Viewers make a pact with the devil, accepting programming without an overt price tag, whose costs are hidden or forgotten. After the initial cost of the idiot box itself, there is ongoing use of electricity, consumed by most sets even when they're off. There are monthly charges for satellite dishes and subscriptions, or cable hookups. And these are just monetary expenses. The most devastating costs are paid by the mind. I tire of hearing from viewers that they can ignore advertising. Then I watch as shoppers go for brand-name goods when less expensive generic products sit untouched. In Costco, people grab Tide brand liquid detergent while its cheaper Kirkland competitor, identical right down to the container, sits untouched. Certainly advertising had nothing to do with their choices. But purchases based on ads from toothpaste to automobiles are inconsequential compared to the social damage caused by political advertising. No major contender has a chance of election unless he or she can present a suitable image on the box. A man like Abraham Lincoln could not be elected dog catcher today as he was, in a word, ugly. And he was long-winded. He spoke to the electorate, expounding on the problems of the day and his proposed solutions. 21st century politicians speak in short spurts of clichés. They run not on policies but on image. One must not be specific as to goals, as each would eliminate some sector of the electorate. better to speak vaguely of growth, jobs, the economy, and such grand general nonsense. An innovation honed, although certainly not invented, by the handlers of Stephen Harper is the television spot dubbed the Attack Ad. Such a product implicitly sends the message, I may be an inept ideologue, ruining our nation, but look how bad the other guy is. The frightening aspect of this type of campaigning is that it works with the masses, voting not for, but against candidates. In case the foregoing rant was too subtle, the medium of television has betrayed its promise. So what else is new? Before television, it was radio that would save humanity from its follies, allowing for universal understanding among peoples. Radio, too, was supposed to unite the world, but, except for niche areas of public and community radio, it, too, became a channel for advertising, sponsoring insipid music, religious blather, and right-wing haranguing of listeners. How sad. You want to go way back, gunpowder was to make war unthinkable, as were later inventions of aerial bombs and nuclear weapons. The advent of manned flight a century ago was to free us from the drudgery of land travel. 100 years of development brought us air and noise pollution, massive airports sprawling across farmlands, and miniature seats and steerage for the masses. Of course, we've also seen such wondrous inventions as the F-16 fighter jet, the B-52 bomber, and the Predator drone, all designed to rain death from the skies. Alexander Bell's telephone would bring instant universal communication. Okay, this is one of the more benign inventions, but look at its stepchild, the cellular phone. On the positive side, the cell phone has allowed emergency communications free of landline telephones. While making remote communication possible, it deprived owners of those refreshing times when they could be free from interference. One used to enjoy time for contemplation and recreation away from work and friends. Now one is expected to be available at any time, day or night, to any idiot who can punch 10 numbers. Couple the cell phone with cars and we have another distraction leading to deadly collisions. I'll not comment on those who develop muscle-bound thumbs exchanging nonsense between multipurpose phone, camera, internet, movie playing, music downloading, GPS-equipped expensive gadgets. The automobile promised freedom to travel great distances rapidly and in comfort. In the 101 years since Ford started cranking out his Model T, society has been transformed beyond the imagination of our ancestors. In the U.S., there are now more cars than drivers. We've spread across the land, paving more farmland and making suburban dwellers totally dependent on their cars. Trucks haul goods from far away, undercutting local products and jobs even as they pollute. That wondrous automobile will be the death of us as oil supplies dwindle and prices rise. Suburbs distance from cities promise to be tomorrow's slums, with residents moving back to cities to avoid expensive commutes. Some predict a day when advanced nations will fragment into feudal bits with a loss of cheap fuel for travel, leading to a loss of social cohesion. Enough of that. Anyone who has thought through the implications of oil depletion will see the trap we've laid for ourselves by total accommodation to fossil fuel addiction. I began this rant with a purpose. It was to talk of our growing dependence on computers and the internet. Society is now dependent on both in ways paralleling our rapid reliance on automobiles a century ago. We know that amateur hackers can do and how their viruses screw up computers worldwide. The Pentagon established a cyber command, the object of which is to protect American computer systems while developing means of taking down those of potential enemies. Other nations are doing the same. Imagine consequences in Canada of computer failures and collapse of the internet connecting them. Our whole financial system is tied up in bits and bytes. Without the internet, our credit and debit cards are useless. Bank accounts would be lost. Business would grind to a halt, including the distribution of food and fuels. As computers become doorstops, transportation and communications would foul. No more traffic lights or air traffic control. No more telephone, landlines, or cells. Hydro systems would go down along with means of heating most homes. Ah, but computers can't all fail, right? Wrong. All it takes is an electromagnetic pulse precipitated by a high-altitude neutron bomb to fry electronics. Every radio, television, telephone, and anything else containing electronics would instantly be disabled. No car manufactured in the last 30 years would run. We would be thrown back into the Stone Age in an instant. Prince George is reputed to have a 3-day supply of food on hand. Then what? We sold ourselves on technology that is alluring yet potentially deadly. I don't want to witness the chaos and brutality that would follow in the wake of its collapse. More happy, happy thoughts from your Uncle Don. 40 years ago, an American astronaut walked on the surface of our satellite. President Obama announced plans to visit the moon again, this time to establish a permanent base serving as a pad for a ship launched to Mars. I will here make a prediction for the records. Americans will indeed return to the moon, and they will establish a permanent base there. They will not use that facility for a Mars excursion. It will be the site of weapons aimed back at our Earth. This is the ultimate goal of a policy the Pentagon calls full-spectrum dominance. Once achieved, this dominance was intended to make the United States militarily unchallengeable. From its moon base, its fleet of armed satellites, its aircraft carrier battle groups on the seven seas, its 700 foreign military bases, its strategic and tactical nuclear missiles, backed by millions of soldiers, sailors, marines, and airmen, the U.S. would dictate to all nations. This ironclad world dominance would be permanent, just like previous empires of Rome, Portugal, Spain, Britain, the Ottoman Empire, the Soviet Union, and Hitler's thousand-year Reich. America has built an enormously expensive inverted pyramid, all resting on an economy in retreat. Who will supply those space and overseas bases when the dollar is no longer trusted? Who will fuel the ships? What nation will want to take devalued dollars to replace the vital natural resources that the United States has squandered over the years? No, it is not certain that they will ever build that moon base if nations to be controlled refuse to finance the ballooning American debt. Interesting times ahead. It looks like NASA plans to send a Canadian on a moon excursion. It figures. Canadians pop up everywhere else. When I traveled on my American passport, it seemed impossible to visit the most remote hovel, cave, or mountaintop without having someone come forward to ask, "Where are you from, eh?" While Americans got around, we usually found ourselves in groups, whereas a Canadian, male or female, would often go it alone to the most unusual places. And Canadians were forcefully independent. I came across one Canadian woman in Indonesia who told me indignantly that a local man had tried to rape her, so she was forced to beat the snot out of him. When I got a ride with six travelers from Kathmandu to Istanbul, sure enough, one was a Canadian girl on her own, fearlessly exploring the world. In the Havana airport, we came across a couple of women from Prince George who had just hitchhiked around the country. I guess I wouldn't have been surprised if the first Americans to hit the moon had been greeted by a human asking, "You got any weed, eh?" I'm hearing and seeing ever more news and opinion speculating as to whether Canada will be willing or able to exit Afghanistan in 2011 as promised. A common theme is that leaving will not be simple. Canada has an obligation to NATO. Canada has an obligation to the Afghan people. If we pull troops, the Americans will retaliate against our vulnerable economy. We must carry on with our reconstruction and training efforts. And finally, the hollow mantra that we must support our troops. How many of us are willing to stand up and say the emperor has no clothes? We didn't send our soldiers and equipment to Afghanistan in response to any threat to Canada. Their gratuitous attack, overthrow of the Afghan government, and the strong arming of NATO into the game was the work of one man, George Wanker Bush. It was his work bribing and threatening Canada to participate in his war. Times have changed. George has returned to his beloved Texas. Canada has sacrificed over 120 soldiers' lives, with many more wounded in body and mind. We have no accurate accounting of dollars and resources squandered to please a despised former American president. Our government's fiscal surplus nosedived into a deep, ongoing deficit, partially due to military expense. Canada could have the nerve to pull out of this war. Now, let's have the integrity to tell the world that we made a mistake. Call it retreat or whatever, we should leave this war, now having dragged on longer than World War II, to those who instigated it. We can't afford the cost in money or lives. Admit that Afghanistan will not be tamed. Great Britain took its men and women went home twice. Russia retreated to lick its wounds. So should we. Of course, my wish is a fantasy as long as we have our current dear leader, Stephen Harper, at the helm. No Canadian sacrifice is too great in his currying favor of American governments, past or present. I do not expect that we will see our soldiers home in 2011. I fully believe that Harper's promise to end our combat role in that year is as empty as any of his others. But we may have a new government of liberals next year. Think that they'll do any differently? Dream on. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. At least the decision as to whether to continue our assault on Afghanistan will be ours alone to make, right? Maybe so, but it's been discovered that America's new ruling party has been feeling out movers and shakers in Ottawa on ways of convincing Canada to keep troops in Afghanistan past our proclaimed deadline of 2011. They're preparing arguments that will persuade Harper to abandon his pledge. That should be easy. It was, after all, just a promise, and he's demonstrated their value. If persuasion fails, we can expect Obama to call his minion at Sussex Drive and issue orders. But this new administration tries not to be so crude. Better to explain the benefits to Canada of acceding to American wishes, and, if necessary, give us a glimpse of the fist within the velvet glove. Sometimes we must be reminded of our vulnerabilities as a colony. The 1972 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is due to expire and needs replacing. In its 37 years, that agreement has been a dismal failure. In 1972, there were five nations possessing atomic bombs. They pledged to enter into negotiations to eliminate them all. This understanding prompted other nations to agree not to build their own nuclear arsenals. Those good faith negotiations never took place. The five signatories now have more deadly bombs and with more accurate delivery systems. Trident nuclear submarines still roam the oceans along with other boomers. We seem to forget these deadly invisible ships until two of them collided in the North Atlantic. Why were they out there? Where were their missiles aimed? What the hell is going on here? Today there are nine nations with nuclear arsenals, including Israel, which denies its possessions. Now is a propitious time for new negotiations. With every country in deficit, none can really afford to maintain such expensive forces. Billion-dollar Trident submarine systems are coming to the end of their useful lives, requiring either replacement or retirement. Prime Minister Brown of Great Britain expressed willingness to cut back or eliminate its Tridents. Will others retire their monsters from the seas? Brown proposes a new non-proliferation treaty, placing the onus on signatories to prove they don't have nuclear weapons. Perhaps this would persuade those possessing them to open their arsenals to international inspection, leading to their eventual dismantling. Russia and the U.S. have agreed to reduce their stockpiles by as much as a third, but this is not as hopeful as it sounds. Each will surely dismantle the oldest and least reliable weapons, scarcely reducing their ability to destroy the planet several times over. Is there a chance that the world will one day be cleansed of nuclear terror we live with daily? There's no chance that the U.S. and Russia will eliminate their arsenals unless others do. Who goes first? The most serious flashpoint now is not North Korea, although that one is not insignificant. It's Israel. If Iran is indeed secretly pursuing atomic bomb technology, it's prompted by fear of Israel's unacknowledged bomb stockpile. Then there's the ongoing standoff between India and Pakistan. They've been at cross swords since partition, but with nuclear weapons, any dispute could erupt into an exchange, the effects of which cannot be imagined. I hope for a new treaty with teeth leading to a day when nuclear weapons becomes items of historical study rather than ongoing fear. But that, as they say, is hope. And hope, Edmund Spencer wrote, to feed on hope, to pine with fear and sorrow. Every year, the University of Northern British Columbia seeks worthy recipients for honorary degrees. My candidate for the 2010 commencements is a man whose battle against injustice and his own government have earned him prominence. I refer to Abdul Razak. Who more deserves recognition for his travails in pursuit of elementary justice from his adopted land? As a commencement speaker, he would be spellbinding. Who would not want to hear of his betrayal at the hands of both liberal and conservative federal governments? I want to hear from this man how he was captured in Sudan at the behest of the Canadian government, how he was tortured and questioned with materials supplied by CSIS, how he was tied in bureaucratic knots in his attempts to return to Canada in spite of explicit rights under our Charter of Rights and Freedoms. His presentation should be attended by Conservative members of Parliament for this area, who would be invited to explain why the Harper regime refused to bring Abdel Razzak home, reneging time and again on promises to expedite it. Perhaps it's time for a groundswell demand from the UNBC community to award an honorary degree to this man. I have nothing against taxes. Taxes are the price that we collectively pay for our civilization. That is, I have nothing against fair taxes, fairly applied and used fairly by governments. Here in British Columbia, we were just told by a jubilant Premier Campbell that our provincial and federal sales taxes will be harmonized next year. Harmonized, what a tuneful word, reminiscent of barbershop quartets. But in application, a bad idea. Campbell says harmonization will be great, as it will allow businesses to collect a single 12% tax in place of two overlapping sales taxes of 5 and 7%. It will save businesses money. Why didn't they think of it earlier? Well, they did, and BC, along with several other promises, rejected the grand plan as detrimental to consumers. This newly harmonized sales tax, effective next July, will extend our provincial sales tax to items previously excluded as necessities. It's acknowledged that this harmonized tax is regressive in effect, that it falls proportionally more on those of low income than high. Broad sales taxes are, by their nature, regressive. The wealthy spend a smaller portion of their incomes on taxable items than do poorer citizens. Money spent on servant wages, on overseas travel, or invested in more for more income is not touched. When I was in Australia, there was a 27.5% tax on luxuries, but none on necessities. That was a reasonable sales tax. My argument against this new tax grab goes beyond its inequitable effects. Look at the process. When was this proposed to the electorate? Campbell had ample opportunities to bring this up before the May election. Why did he not? Was he afraid that the electorate might disapprove? Was this proposal brought before our legislature? I think not. Why have we succumbed to a system of rule by fiat when Canada is supposed to be a democracy? Taxes can be dumped on us without discussion. We can be taken into participating in someone else's unjust war without popular consent. I would be out on the street demanding a revolution if I weren't aware that most rebellions, starting with high ideals, come a cropper. Idealists find themselves throwing out one batch of bastards only to be saddled with another crop of bastards. With Canadians as complacent as most are, we're far from being able to get the average person out to vote, much less get them excited by another instance of arrogant leaders screwing us yet again. Our collective complacency is our undoing. Enough of this. Let's get back to the local scene where we continue to be shafted in preparation for the 2010 Olympic fiasco. If it weren't for the fantastic expense of the coming fortnight's party, British Columbians might not be saddled with that harmonization tax picking our pockets for an extra 7% on many purchases. Campbell agreed to surrender provincial taxation to the feds, partly because Harper offered a bribe in excess of $1 billion, dollars that will have to be added to the federal debt, to cover supposed adjustment expenses. That money, siphoned from the rest of the nation, will come in handy for Campbell as he tries to cover out-of-control Olympic costs. Free speech takes a beating as police intimidating those identify as games opponents. The head of the designated 2010 Integrated Security Unit warned of groups around Canada and around the world that are planning to criminally disrupt the sacred Olympics and Hitler's legacy of torch relays. Official goons confronted suspects in their homes, workplaces, and during leisure, ostentatiously questioning them about their plans. Students at UBC had been forced into tenancy agreements forbidding them from posting signs or displays on dorm windows and buildings. The university is afraid kids might express dissatisfaction with the concept of wasteful athletic contests, their expense, and the disruptions caused by the party. But fear not. Free speech will be allowed protesters. Taking a page from China's practice, they intend to establish free speech zones where citizens can chant, picket, and post banners, well away from the eyes and ears of those who might be influenced or offended. I've proposed that the entire city of Prince George bid for the privilege of being so designated in hopes of receiving a free speech grant from VANOC. Where better to isolate protesters than 800 kilometers north of the venues, where they would not be a nuisance? We might even provide old tires and junk cars for them to burn for the television cameras. It would be great theater. Meanwhile, the Olympics would cause disruptions far from Vancouver or Whistler. British Columbia will essentially shut down criminal courts as police are seconded to security duties. With a paucity of police witnesses, trials cannot proceed. Little mentioned is the potential for a minor crime wave, as depleted police detachments find themselves unable to perform more than skeleton tasks. This will be a fine time for biker gangs to strut their stuff. Watch for more shootouts on the streets of our fair city. Albertans have also been warned that their justice system will be crippled by a police shortage. Oops, I shouldn't say crippled, as that's no longer politically correct. And I guess handicapped is out of favor, too. Let me correct that. To their justice system will be challenged. In any case, Alberta will lose as many as 600 of its 2,000 RCMP officers to temporary duties at the Olympics. Back in the real world, safely away from steroids and the glamour of silly games, we are, according to economists, experiencing recovery from a recession. However, we're warned that this is a jobless recovery. Does this sound like an oxymoron to you, or just the ravings of ordinary morons? Who does a recovery serve, if not those who perform actual work in society? It brings back the question as to whether society exists to feed the markets, or vice versa. Companies are finding ways to increase production without rehiring laid-off workers. This is what is blandly referred to as increasing productivity, that is, squeezing more out of a workforce fearful of joining their brothers and sisters fallen through a shredded social safety net. We've been told that rising productivity is the linchpin of economic growth and rising living standards. But for whom? Will workers be in a position to gain a share of the fruits of their productivity as unions are decimated and fear rules their lives? Not that they weren't complicit in their fate. Those who went on spending binges, running up debts, living from paycheck to paycheck are in no position to risk their income flow by making demands. So we'll have our jobless recovery, with the fruits of productivity increases going to foreign corporations and executives who will again award themselves outrageous bonuses on the back of consumers and workers alike. Nuts. Why is Iran so adamant in its pursuit of nuclear technology in the face of international opposition? If we take their claims at face value, that they need nuclear power to supplement their electricity capacity and not to produce nuclear weapons, it seems to make no sense. Why not contract nuclear reactor construction to experienced companies like General Electric, Westinghouse, and our AECL? Why not buy uranium fuel on the world market as others do? I recently discovered the answer. When the Islamic Revolution overthrew the Shah in 1979, the reaction of the United States was immediate. It had, after all, in 1953, used the CIA to overthrow the elected leader, Mohammad Mossadegh, and install the Shah as dictator. Mossadegh had made the tactical error of nationalizing the Iranian oil industry 2 years earlier, and the U.S. government was not amused. When Iranians had the temerity to depose the American puppet, foreign companies and countries refused to honor all signed contracts for nuclear fuel and technology. 30 years later, Iranians remember that agreements with foreigners exist at the whim of their governments. This time they intend to get into nuclear power on their own, using their own technology, their own technicians, and their own domestic supplies of uranium. Before we swallow the official line on any controversy like this, we'd do well to look at the history and explore it for holes convenient to those attempting to manipulate our opinions. This closes the 320th edition of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia.